PD Pods present the PD Podscast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to episode 22 of the PD Podscast, hosted by myself, Pranay Buddha. In keeping with our previous episode where we spoke to Dr. Alaric Arugis from Bombay, India, I'm very pleased to be sitting down with Dr. Marie Tiart, who's a pediatric orthopedic surgeon in South Africa. She works at Tygerberg Hospital outside of Cape Town, is a senior lecturer at the Stellenbosch University, and was a founding member of the South African Female Orthopedic Surgeon Society. She also sits on the executive committee of the newly formed International Orthopedic Diversity Alliance as the Africa Regional Representative. And we're going to have a great conversation about her journey into pediatric orthopedics and the current standpoint in South African practice. We'll obviously then talk about the importance of mentoring and what led her to founding the Female Orthopedic Society. Dr. Tiart, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm very excited.
So first of all, I think it's important our listeners know that you're currently in Tier 4 lockdown in South Africa. That's to a lot of people in a lot of countries are, most people are fed up of this, but one thing that's most annoying probably is that you can't even purchase alcohol out there, I've heard. Tell me, how have you managed?
As South Africans, we are very resourceful people. And so with our previous hard lockdown, many of us took to the internet and learned how to brew our own pineapple beer. But of course, South Africans are also pretty shrewd. So those that own supermarkets quickly learned that pineapples were an important sort of source of income. And so the prices essentially skyrocketed and tripled eventually. So I hope that most people bought their pineapples before the president spoke on Sunday, just because we all sort of knew that this hard lockdown was coming. So hopefully everyone has pineapple in order to brew that beer that we're so infamous for.
Well, I say this in jest, but actually, the reason for them doing that is to essentially offload the healthcare system and emergency departments, or that's the excuse they're using anyway. Tell me, over the last year during COVID, how was your practice impacted in South Africa with regards to pediatric orthopedics?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a really trying time. So essentially, when the numbers got quite severe regarding COVID, the issue was really the lack of hospital beds. So we had to open up beds for these medical patients. So our orthopedic pediatric beds were then reduced to then include the general surgeons, the pediatric surgeon kids into our wards, and the non-COVID respiratory pediatric patients. So we lost beds. And then from a theater point of view, all our elective theaters were stopped. And this is quite difficult with pediatrics because a lot of our things are not really elective. I mean, they're time sensitive. So that was quite stressful, knowing that you've got children that are requiring 8 plates for angular deformities or worse, removal of 8 plates. All our congenital hip dislocations had to be on ice. All our Blount's corrective surgeries had to stop. And essentially, from a surgical point of view, we were only doing trauma and infection, which we see a great deal of. And then, of course, if we could sort of sway or swing sort of prominent hardware as a, urgent case, we used to sort of sneak those patients in, sort of like the 8-plate removals. The idea about decreasing theater, it seemed, was then to mobilize nursing staff as well as anesthetic registrars to be able to work in the COVID wards and the COVID ICUs. So that was sort of the idea behind losing the theater lists. Our elective clinics were also scaled down. So our trauma clinic still ran, but P's, all our elective clinics were decreased, probably to about a third of the numbers, because obviously I'm still seeing my post-op infection kids or my recently post-op elective cases were still being seen, because you can't not see a child post osteomyelitis, etc. So, and then we were trying to obviously spend as sort of little time with each other as clinicians. So trying to stay away from the tea room, trying to, you know, clear the clinics and leave. So our clinics work very differently from the UK, or where I was in the UK, where your patients have got, you know, a selected time where they come for their appointments. Our patients, unfortunately, it's sort of a first come, first serve. So everyone arrives in the morning and you essentially try and see people as quick as possible to get them out of the clinic. And so your clinic, if you, you know, depending on how quickly you work, and obviously your rate limiting factors, things like x-ray department, but you could be done with your clinic at midday or 3 o'clock, depending. So we were trying to mobilize as many of our registrars to do as many of the, you know, be in the trauma clinic so that we could get people home and, you know, trying to sort of be sort of exposed to people as little as possible, if that makes sense.
Over lockdown, you know that, you know, we presented at the South African Orthopaedic Meeting our paper about trampoline injuries, because children were essentially being kept at home and parents were trying to keep them occupied so they could carry on remote working. Did you see any difference, increase or decrease in the types of injuries you saw in children over lockdown? I know a lot of your trauma is usually high energy sort of road traffic accidents as well. Did you see any difference?
I have to think back, because it's really interesting. Even though in winter we have a lot of rainy weather and it's cold, our sort of, we don't have a spike of trauma cases. Our trauma, in especially in pediatrics, is pretty constant throughout the year, regardless of the weather. So there was definitely no sort of obvious sort of spike. I will say what I did notice is we had a lot of pathological fractures in our osteogenesis children. So because endocrine cancelled their elective clinics and the kids were not getting bisphosphonate, we had far more fractures of our osteogenesis children, far more than we normally see. That I can remember. That was quite significant. And then regarding normal trauma, it was sort of business as usual. We had a little bit more non-accidental injury, I have to say. I think because people are at home getting frustrated, et cetera, you know, being cooped up in a small sort of, you know, home with your whole family can obviously be quite trying. So we definitely saw more non-accidental injury. You know, we see easily, I know this is shocking to even believe, but we see easily 2 to 3 supracondylars a day. And that can be summer, winter, spring, it doesn't matter. Weekend, week, it doesn't matter. It's all the time. Mm.
Which means your registrars obviously get great training in how to manage them, of course. So let's go right back to the beginning. You know, tell us a bit about your childhood, growing up, and what led you into orthopedic surgery and subsequently into pediatric orthopedics?
Yeah, that's a very interesting topic. So I was born with what my parents deem was clubfoot. My parents are neither medical. I'm actually the first doctor in the family. And it was the 80s, so there was no ponseti. So I had multiple surgeries on my feet, as well as it sounds like I actually had quite a lot of in-toeing that was probably from femoral, antiversion. And I think it was the time when there wasn't that much, there wasn't good research out, I think, in the 80s. So I had derotations done of my femurs at like the age of 5. Which now you and I would sort of, don't worry, mom, it's going to get better. Come and see us when she's an early teen, you know, kind of thing. But I had derotations done by a very prominent pediatric orthopedic surgeon and a very good orthopedic surgeon. And the one distal femur side on the left got some kind of vascular assault. And so I had a physial sort of temporary growth arrest on the distal femur, and I now have a short leg on the left of 2.5 centimeters, which at maturity. So I used to, when I was sort of a teenager, have the whole built-up shoe and the insole, etc. And then only when I like studied orthopedics and I was like, well, most of the population is 2 centimeters, so now I just wear an insole for that last little bit kind of thing. But I think that probably sort of like sparked my interest in medicine. Ironically, you know, I was that typical sort of, you know, straight A student, leadership roles in high school, etc. And I actually didn't get into medicine the first time. I got into architecture, which is, it takes like 20 people a year. It's the most, it's one of the hardest things to get into at the University of Pretoria, where I grew up, you know, where I'm from. And I just looked at these little models that these people did at open day, and I was like, I can't do this. I can't do architecture. Like, there's just no way. And so I did a BSc for 6 months. And then, because our system is such that you can then get in, if you've got good marks in your, in those first 6 months, you can get into medicine. And I was lucky and got into medicine like that. So after medicine, we do 1 year of internship, and then we do a year of what they call community service. And no, listeners, this does not mean that I have a criminal record and had to do some time to stay out of prison. Community service in our country is essentially the government has subsidized your training, and it's your way of giving back. So they send you basically in that year to somewhere sort of rural, into a small hospital to go and sort of give back to the community. I did internship so long ago that we did 1 year and we did 4 month rotations, and I did general surgery, pediatrics, and obs and gyne. That's all. There was no orthopedics that I could choose from, but I'd done really well as a med student in orthopedics. And I was I liked maths, I liked geometry, I liked physics. And I just enjoyed that sort of the angles and like, this is how you reduce things. And the patients were amazing. You know, you fix people. You're not managing people, you're fixing people. So I think it was probably a combination of, I did very well in peds, I did very well in orthopedics. And then when I did ComServe, I was sort of the only person interested in orthopedics. So there was no, I was literally stuck in a very small town in a small hospital. So it wasn't, there was no operative management of orthopedics, but all the manipulations or the pops and things I used to manage. And then essentially how it works here is then you become what we call a medical officer. So you're pre-training number. And then I decided, okay, I'm sort of stuck. I don't know if I want to do general surgery or do I want to do orthopedics, and maybe fate will just decide for me. And so I applied for sort of both posts and got neither, and then ended up in another really small town for literally 4 months as a general medical officer. And then an orthopedic post opened at Worcester Hospital. And I was just lucky enough to then interview and get that post with no orthopedic surgical training. So I'd done like obviously some normal general surgery cutting, but no like orthopedics. But like day one in that orthopedic department, I had a drain of septic arthritis. I still remember it. And I just realized this is where I need to be. This is where I need to be. Even though I'd never done any sort of operative work, I knew this is, you know, my future. And then my reg time, I came to Stellenbosch University. So at the time, and still is, it's the best university to specialize in orthopedics in South Africa. And I started here in 2011. And actually I was really sort of taken with hand surgery. When I look back now, I can't believe it. You know, when you're like, how could I have enjoyed or thought that was now the path for me? We have to do a research project. We call it like a Masters of Medicine. And my research project was in a hand topic, so intra-articular distal radiuses. And so I concentrated on hands, you know, sort of went to all those congresses and things like that until I did PEDS, which was really late. I only did it in my fourth year, and we do 5 years. And when I did PEDS, my boss at the time, who's now our head of department, said to me, look, I really think you need to do PEDS. I think this is where you're meant to be. And I think long term, this is where you need to be. You need to be back at Stellenbosch, back at Tygerberg Hospital doing PEDS. So now it was quite late. You know, I had a year left of reg time, and now I had to start looking for fellowships. There's no pediatric fellowships in South Africa. And a lot of the fellowships, you know, like the Canadians and the New Zealanders and Australians, their fellowships are full up sort of 3 to 4 years beforehand. So obviously deciding on PEDS so late was not good in that sense. However, all the UK fellowships have a more reasonable time, you know, from sort of interview to starting date. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to try for the UK. And I love the fact that you've interviewed Mr. Nicolau, because he has come out to South Africa to Congress as one of our invited speakers. And I thought to myself, I remember this name. This name is so familiar. And he interviewed me for the Sheffield Fellowship, and then declined me. There was two of them. And afterwards, he came to me when I'd met him in South Africa, and I sort of teased him, you know, and said, oh, yes, you sort of declined me for that fellowship. And he said, I thought I recognized your name. And he was like, you know what? There were two of us in that interview. I desperately wanted you. And the other guy, it was his registrar that was applying for the fellowship. So it was, you know, it was one of those things. But I think it was actually, you know, things work out the way they should. And then I got an interview at Southampton, and I got the post at Southampton. And I actually got an interview afterwards, you know, when you've applied for many of them. And I had an interview at Liverpool, but I'd already got the Southampton post. And so I declined the interview because I knew I was, you know, going to go to Southampton. And it would have been fascinating. I really enjoyed my time in Southampton, but it would have been amazing to work with Dan Perry. Because now, you know, he's such a well-known name, and, you know, I follow him on Twitter, and I've been following his research when I worked in the UK, and it would have been really interesting to see if my, you know, how my life would have turned out differently if I had gone to Liverpool. But essentially, once my reg time was over, I ended up in Southampton in their pediatric department, and it was just so different from ours. So when we look at sort of the medical structure in South Africa, we've got about 20% of the medical workforce working in state hospitals. So for people that don't have private healthcare, and that is about 80% of the population. So you've got the small amount of people that are servicing a huge population. And then you've got about 20% of people working in private healthcare. 80% of the surgeons working in private healthcare, and they are servicing only 20% of the population. So as crazy as it sounds, at Tygerberg Hospital, in our Department of Orthopedics, we are about 9 full-time consultants with a few part-time consultants. And when I went to Southampton and I was working in their pediatric orthopedic department, they had like 9 pediatric consultants. And it was just an eye opener, because it was so different. It was just unbelievable to imagine that there are 9 people all working in just pediatric orthopedics. Everyone is equally busy, which is incredible. And then to essentially work and know I'm coming back to work in Tygerberg, where I'm the only full-time consultant. And then our head of department used to be the pediatric orthopedic consultant. So he comes in and helps in theater on occasion, sort of normally like a Friday morning is his time in theater with me. But from a clinical point of view, like running the ward and all the actual clinics, that is, I'm the only consultant. And that is normal. That is normal in South Africa. It's crazy, but it's just the way what we're used to. And when we look at sort of what we do in the pediatric sense, I have to treat all the pediatrics, from the cerebral palsy to the blound, to the infections, to the fractures, to the hip dysplasias, Whereas obviously in the UK, everyone has their little niche, which is awesome. But it's not financially feasible in South Africa, really.
That's absolutely incredible. And there's so much to take in there. You know, the first thing you said is you yourself were a patient when you were younger. And I don't know if you know of the paper that's shown that a huge percentage of patients who underwent pediatric orthopedic surgery actually end up getting into the medical field. So that's incredible to start off as early as that. And obviously now you're serving a huge population. I know recently on World Clubfoot Day, you were managing obviously patients with clubfoot. So it's done the full circle. Tell me a bit more about your time in Southampton. You obviously were working with an incredible team. It's attached to university, which comes with its own extra joys of things like teaching and research as well. But obviously, you always knew you were going to come back to Tygerberg out in Cape Town, and you were going to be practicing in a very different social setup. What did you learn from your time in Southampton?
I think I learned sort of things to help me from obviously a surgical point of view, as well as quite a lot of life skills and managerial skills. This is maybe something strange to hear, but I learned quite a lot of patience, because I think, I think it's amazing that in the UK you're incredibly patient-centered, and there is a lot of time and effort spent getting, you know, sort of discussing the pathology, discussing the surgical options, planning with the parents what all the options are and what would be best, etc. Unfortunately, I don't think we are as au fait with that as you guys are in South Africa. I think we, because of the pressure of the numbers that we see, I don't think we always take the time to spend with our patients. And I had to learn, you know, that I learned a lot of patience and sort of like, I don't know how to put this, sort of, yeah, just the really good sort of patient interaction and patient centeredness that I could bring back and sort of work on here. So that was really important for me to learn. I still miss today. I really enjoyed the team sort of the team feel among the anesthetic team, the nursing staff, the surgical team. You know, everyone sort of used to joke and sort of jest about the timeouts, you know, and the huddle in the morning. But actually, when you're not doing that routinely, you know, we do, please listeners, we do a WHO checklist, but it is definitely not to British standards. And I miss that. I miss the huddle of everyone introduces themselves, everyone says their role, what the plan is for the day. It was awesome, but we move at such a pace here that it's not always possible, you know. But I am really make a point of doing a WHO before every patient, before we cut, we discuss what we're going to do, what we need, etc. And I really sort of spend a lot of time having good sort of communication with my nursing staff and my anaesthetist, because that's really important to having a happy day at work, you know, in theater. So I really enjoy that sort of team feel. From a surgical point of view, I think because our system is so trauma run and trauma heavy, we don't always get the opportunity to really do a lot of elective work. And I actually learned a lot regarding elective work. That the Southampton Centre is huge for hip dysplasia, and I did quite a lot of, you know how it works there, you know, as a fellow, you're going to be observing for a long time and then assisting and then actually, you know, being the primary surgeon, etc. And that, you know, really helped me when I came back, because we do see quite a lot of hip dysplasia in South Africa, more than we probably, you know, sort of thought. From a trauma point of view, even though we see a lot of trauma, it was still really beneficial to see another way of doing things, and also doing it sort of almost more sort of by the book, if that makes sense, instead of learning on the job and this is just how I do it. I really actually learned quite a lot of trauma tips and tricks from our consultants in Southampton. So that was definitely beneficial. And of course, I worked a lot with Miss Caroline Edwards doing cerebral palsy work. She is the main surgeon running the cerebral palsy clinics, and I spent a lot of time working in her clinic and in theatre with her. And she really helped me regarding decision making, being able to sort of analyze gait analyses and then the actual surgery. And I do quite a lot of cerebral palsy work because, of course, in South Africa, we have a lot of cerebral palsy as well. So for me, it was a really beneficial year as a fellow. And then essentially the plan was for me to come back to South Africa. But as, you know, fate, et cetera, but HR had made some kind of miscalculation with the locums contract who was in my post. And so I couldn't come back. There was no post for me. And, you know, it's quite overwhelming to then work in a hospital where they literally conjured up a post for me and allowed me to stay on as the locum consultant. And, you know, it wasn't an easy decision coming back to South Africa when you are so, you know, loved and wanted, you know, in the place that you're working. And it was, you know, I can only, you know, say thank you to them every time I see them at like their, what's the right word? Sort of the way that they opened their heart, themselves up to me and then accommodated me when they didn't have to, essentially, when I was finished with my fellowship.
Yeah, it sounds like you had an incredible time and you were very fortunate to work, you know, with such amazing colleagues, obviously, out there. But you had a bigger role to serve in South Africa, which you're obviously doing now, taking over, you know, pediatric orthopedic care for a huge region and population. And you also highlight there what I talk about a lot when I speak to surgeons about their fellowship experiences, which is it's not just about going and learning about how to do an operation or, you know, as you sort of mentioned, it's about the approach to the patient, the approach to parents, counseling, consenting, but also the more soft skills with regards to building teams, management, leadership, and understanding where you enjoy your job the most, essentially. One thing quite unique to Southampton, I guess, as you sort of mentioned, is they have a quite high proportion of female orthopedic surgeons there, and that must have inspired you because I know you're a founding member of the South African Female Orthopedic Surgeon Society. So tell me what brought you to that, because it's a relatively new organization.
Yes. So essentially, when I was a registrar, there were very few female registrars before me. And it was a different time then. The department is very different, but it was everyone was really sort of geared to getting themselves trained and out the door, essentially. And there was very little in the sense of even informal mentorship or role modeling for when I was a registrar. And then when I went to Southampton and I was now surrounded by a lot of female consultants as well as other female fellows and female registrars, because Southampton is a very high proportion of female registrars, and it was normal. You know, that's the way I can put it. It was normal. It was not the sort of having to always explain yourself or, you know, the GPs phoning in and speaking to a female voice and then making some kind of snide joke about, oh, are women allowed to specialize in orthopedics now, you know, kind of thing. So I found a real sense of camaraderie and support. And it was extremely informal, you know, but it was amazing what they taught me regarding, and it was probably, they don't even realize that they did it, but it was watching them. Does that make sense? Like watching them interact with colleagues, interact with patients, how they conducted themselves, how, you know, that was inspiring. And it made me sort of think, wow, I need to do this for my juniors when I go back. I need to, this was amazing to work with so many women that were, you know, giving you sort of pearls regarding life skills, et cetera. I'll never forget that one of the consultants, we went together to IPOS, and she had decided to enroll in their sort of mentorship for the duration of IPOS. And she got a male mentor that was quite much older. He's probably in his 60s. And he actually sat her down at the one lunch and said, if I can give you any advice as a woman in, you know, in orthopedics or in a male dominated field, and he said, lower your voice slightly and speak slightly slower, and men will take you seriously. And I know this sounds crazy, but it I do understand, you know, what he was saying. And she, you know, shared that with me. Not that I have a very high pitched voice, but it was just interesting that sometimes sort of tell it like it is advice is actually good advice. Because he was giving it from a place of love and support. And I think definitely that is, you know, it would stand her in good stead. And I still remember her telling me when she did her fellowship in Australia. And the female consultants that she and fellow, you know, peers taught her how to walk in high heels, because she'd never known how to walk in high heels. And they were like, come, let us show you. Then you can wear, you know, nice high heels to work and look all professional. And they taught her how to wear high heels. It's just, it's funny sort of life skills like this that you take away. And I have to say that the professional work wear in the UK, I brought back to South Africa. Ironically, we might be quite a conservative nation sometimes, but from a work point of view, I don't think we always, we definitely don't dress normally as formally as our British colleagues. And I've brought that back and I've stuck to it because it makes me feel confident and, you know, sort of good about myself. And when I walk into the clinic, the patients know this is the consultant that's walking into the clinic. And that's the thing, you need to dress for the job that you have and want, and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I still wear a suit and tie to work, although, you know, to be honest, after spending some time in Australia and also in Hawaii, I could very much wear shorts or scrubs like a lot of them do as well. Tell me a bit about SAFOS, which is the Female Orthopaedic Society, because I know it's recently been acknowledged by the South African Orthopaedic Association as a really important entity in sort of changing the culture of orthopaedics in the region. And what's the sort of mission and goal with it?
Okay, so I think once I got back to South Africa, at one of the sort of more, it must have been 2019 Congress, Dr. Leon Raja, who was the then SAOA president, actually sort of approached me and said he wants to just chat to me about maybe doing some research in women in orthopedics in South Africa. You know, what is it like? What's the experience, etc.? Because he has two nieces that are medical students, and he had asked them, What do you want to specialize in, or what determines what you want to specialize in? And their response was sort of lack of female, you know, role models, not being able to see women, you know, as the consultants there, as well as their perception of certain women in different specialities. And he just was fascinated that maybe this is research we need to do because we have so few women. So we have 51 registered, you know, as the Americans would call it, board certified So we've got 51 registered orthopedic surgeons, so consultants working in private and state, that are female in South Africa out of 1,008. So that is a 5% amount, which is about what it is everywhere, isn't it? I mean, that's the numbers for America. I think the British is about 6%. So we are a minority. And I think it was sort of his sort of push to research, plus this this sort of mentorship informally and the support I got in Southampton that made me think we need to do something here, you know, from a society point of view. And it wasn't easy. It wasn't without some concerns from our male counterparts. But I think things just aligned really well in the sense of we introduced the society in 2020 at the same time that Christy Weber was the outgoing American president. She, the Americans, Canadians, New Zealanders, Australians, and the British presidents are always invited to our SAOA annual congress. So it was, you know, sort of fate that that was the year I decided to introduce this society. And she was sitting on the panel because it wasn't met with absolute 100% support. And having her on the panel, as well as the other international presidents that had similar societies, like the Australians have the Owls and, you know, the New Zealanders have the Lionesses, et cetera. And the Canadians are definitely, you know, pushing towards a diversity. It was the support from those international presidents that actually helped sort of win over the association, essentially. So now SAFOS is a society that is affiliated with SAOA. So they recognize us as a society, but we are completely independent. And I've kept it like that because our main sort of aim is to improve the experience of training as well as attract more women into orthopedics. So it was very fascinating when I did the numbers. So if we looked at women in medical officer posts, so pre-training number, we had currently in last year something like 40 odd women all in orthopedic medical officer posts. But then when we look at the conversion to a registrar post, we only had 20 women. And then, you know what I mean? So we need to get those 40 to become 40 registrars and not have any, as they call it, attrition, you know, drop out of, or, you know, disinterest or, yeah, we need to convert those medical officer posts into training number registrar posts. So that's the aim. So our society's got consultants in it. We've got registrars. We've got medical officers. We're currently sitting at 50 members. And essentially advertising for this was social media, obviously at the Congress, et cetera. And then within the society, we've got a mentorship program. So obviously somebody senior mentors somebody junior. So we've obviously then got registrars that are mentoring medical officers and consultants that are mentoring either registrars or medical officers. And essentially it's just to have somebody more senior to you that you can contact and discuss things with and share and have support, et cetera. And then in this year, we've had a few webinars, thanks to COVID, where we've had some guest speakers chat about, you know, different things that are topical to female orthopedic surgeons.
Yeah, and it's been great because we've seen a huge push in strengthening women in orthopedics, but also inclusivity and diversity in orthopedics. And that's really worldwide. You know, there's been the Ruth Jackson Orthopedic Society, there's been the Perry Initiative out in the US, there's obviously in the UK, there's been a big push. And as you mentioned, with COVID, it's allowed us to meet people from around the world virtually, which, you know, means we're not taking time away from our families, jumping on a plane for 4 days away from them. We actually get to have these conversations. And it's been incredible to see. And one, you know, we interviewed Dr. Jennifer Weiss earlier this year. And, you know, something her and Dr. Nancy and Shipley are really pushed for is this Speak Up Ortho, which is, you know, large on probably on Twitter, social media, Instagram, and has really highlighted the discrimination and prejudice that, you know, females especially have felt within the field. And it's really calling it out. And what that has led to is obviously something that you are now involved in, which is the International Orthopaedic Diversity Alliance. So, you know, you haven't just set up SAPOS, you've also committed to recruiting a whole continent. You're the Africa representative on the exec committee. Tell me a bit about IODA and what its goals are and what your role is within that newly formed sort of institution.
Yeah, so IODA, I think again with COVID, has picked up an incredible amount of momentum regarding formulating and forming an executive committee, as well as becoming more visible from a social media aspect. Because I think IODA has been around probably for a few more years than we actually, you know, sort of, that they were visibly, you know, present. And I think it's just really helped now, as we've spoken about, having COVID and having this sort of ease of connecting regarding Zoom and social media platforms. And that's really given it its snowball effect. So I'm the African representative on the executive committee. And essentially, my goals are to try and make contact with women orthopedic surgeons in each African country, and essentially to form a network of women that we can then, you know, support and communicate and liaise with, etc., to be able to identify what it's like, what's orthopedic like in their countries, what are the numbers looking like, what is it like to train there, etc. Because we don't really know unless your country has actually published on this. There isn't really, we don't know enough. I recently read an article about the general surgeons in Rwanda. There's a research article about women in diversity there. And so we know something about general surgeons in Rwanda, but we don't know anything about the orthopedic surgeons. So it's been quite a challenge to be able to network to each African country, but I'm definitely making progress, which is reassuring, again, because we're so used to social media and connecting with one another. And I think, yeah, it's important for us to promote diversity and inclusion, and I think that is IODA's main aim. And at the moment, the sort of the buzzwords are gender diversity, but I think long term it will be to be improving the situation for all minority groups, which is obviously dependent on each country.
And we'll put in the show notes here, you know, where you can find out more about IODA and also about SAPHOS as well. So please do check that out as well. I know before you mentioned there are currently no pediatric orthopedic fellowships in South Africa. Is that something you see changing? And where do you see the specialty of pediatric orthopedics within the country in the future?
I think definitely fellowships are on the cards. I know we are at Stellenbosch definitely looking at creating a pediatric fellowship. We've got a lot of interest, you know, people that want to come to us to do a fellowship, local and international, because we see such a variety of pathology and quite a lot of severe pathology. So I think that'll definitely happen. I think the problem with everything in a third world country is funding. It all is going to come down to the finance, because it's not down to the enthusiasm of the consultants wanting to teach or the accessibility to patients or the amount of work you'd see, because that we have in spades, you know, buckets full over here. But it's going to come down to the financial situation regarding being able to pay a fellowship salary for a year. And then I think pediatric orthopedics is really becoming quite a big subspecialty, especially now with the sort of more evolution of limb reconstruction, because I think quite a lot of our work now, you know, before when we didn't have sort of maybe access, or there wasn't that much research and development regarding lengthening nails, and, you know, frames for lengthening weren't big, you know, whatever, 20 years ago. That is now, you know, that sort of innovation is becoming absolutely sort of standard of care, definitely in our departments. And if we look at sort of the limb reconstruction stuff, my adult colleague does a lot of the adult recon, but I do, you know, as a pediatric unit, we do all the pediatric reconstructive stuff as well. So there's a lot of framework that we do, and lengthening nails, etc. And then our center as well, and I'm sure that's also with time going to become pretty normal, we have a 3D printer. So we do quite a lot of our sort of severe deformities, some of our blounts that we need to correct. If we've got severe coxobaras, we print them with 3D printing so that we can do some pre-op surgical planning. So that's, I think, from a sort of future innovation point of view, I think that's going to become pretty sort of norm, if that makes sense. Yeah, so I think the biggest sort of forward motion is going to be the innovation that has come with limb reconstruction in the 3D printing industry.
Yeah, and I think it's also important for people to know, you mentioned to me before we started this conversation, there's only around 20 to 25 pediatric orthopedic surgeons in the whole of South Africa. So I'm sure there will be hopefully a push towards increasing the number of surgeons and therefore be able to help more people as part of that.
Yeah, I think exactly. I think the problem, of course, is that in the state sector, there are only so many consultant posts available, because that's what the government can pay for financially every year, even though there's definitely a need for more consultants, you know, to be here and to be working, because there is a lot of work and that isn't going to change.
And finally, you know, you seem, as one of nine surgeons that pretty much look after a huge region and, you know, essentially heading up the pediatric orthopedic service for your whole area, being a founding member of SAFOS and also the Africa representative for IODA. Tell me, what do you do in your spare time? I know you and me have jested a lot with each other recently about the Formula One season and how Lewis Hamilton is, of course, the best driver so far.
Yes, I am a huge Formula One fan, I have to say. So at the moment, especially when we had that sort of lull of races when the COVID was hitting quite badly, I think it's this welcome relief that we're getting so many races in. And of course, one never wants to speak too loudly and jinx anything, but it is very exciting that Red Bull is now competitive to Mercedes, and that it seems like we've won four races in a row, you know, but no one wants to jinx, you know, the victories that Max Verstappen has been having. So you and I jest a lot about Formula One, and long may it last that Red Bull can remain competitive, shall I say.
And what other things do you enjoy doing? And what would you say to our listeners is your favorite thing about Cape Town and where you live?
Oh, wow. So I think it's so funny, right? Like, I don't know about you, but maybe a little bit younger than me, so maybe this is still coming for you. But the older I get, the more active I seem to want to become, you know, you know, when I was a registrar, maybe because we were studying so much, you know, and you had other things to focus on, I didn't really enjoy things like hiking and being outdoors, etc. But now as a consultant, it's like a new lease on life. You're a different person, and you have all this time in your hands. And living in Cape Town, obviously at the foot of Table Mountain, I spend quite a lot of time hiking the mountain and the surrounds. So that's generally what I do, even in winter, depending on the rain, but even in winter. So I think that is one of the nicest things to do in Cape Town is to hike the mountain or the surrounds. But I know what you want me to say is to drink wine on wine farms, because that is what we're also well known for. And I do obviously enjoy a little bit of wine, and we have incredible vineyards and incredible sunsets. And every time I speak to any international, colleagues, I always tell them, when COVID lifts, you need to come visit. It's amazing, and I will extend the invitation to you as well.
Well, there's definitely no need to convince me. I'll be there as soon as lockdown is over. Dr. Tiart, thank you so much for your time today. It's been incredible to hear about your journey and your experience in our field of pediatric orthopedics, your role in improving and diversity, and your role with SAPOS in trying to mentor the younger generation of surgeons to come. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you, and I really look forward to meeting face to face in the future and messaging more about Formula One.
Yes, exactly. Thank you so much for having me. This was amazing. And I do also, I'm looking forward to meeting face to face as well once COVID subsides.